This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast for Wednesday, January the 29th, 2020. Thank you so much for joining me today. As always, the podcast is listener supported. So I've tried to do this opening now three or four different times, and I just keep getting lost in my own words. And I'll tell you kind of why that is here in a couple of minutes. But if you go to patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast to make a contribution to the show takes time, it takes energy, it takes money to be able to do the publishing fees, but also then the equipment and all the things that go into it. So now close to 110 episodes in, I just wanted to express my gratitude to the following people. Thank you to Chad, Anthony, Jennifer, Eddie, Jenny, Sean, Christina, Holly, Ross, Caroline, Julie, Casey, Alyssa, Brian, Sarah, Adrian, Kristen, Sarah, Stan, Helen, Arnie, Barb, Kim. Thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart for contributing to the podcast. And if for some reason you don't feel like making any sort of a contribution monetarily speaking to the show, one of the best things you can do is if you are listening on an Apple device to leave an iTunes review. And if you're listening on some kind of another device, going over to the Facebook page and leaving some kind of a review there. So today's interview is fantastic. One of my favorites ever. And I recorded this podcast with Dr. Dan Ratner, who's a psychotherapist, a TMS psychotherapist now in Cleveland, that we're going to get to here in a minute. But we recorded this interview a week ago, and over the weekend, obviously on Sunday, the news of Kobe Bryant's passing and Gianna Bryant's passing and the other seven people that were in the helicopter happened. And I don't know why exact. Well, I might have an idea why. On this particular celebrity passing, has just felt so personal and so raw. And I wish that I could tell you exactly why that's the case. I actually came across a great quote yesterday because, you know, one thing, I was listening to Howard Stern yesterday morning or yesterday afternoon, and there were quite a few people that were calling in and they were saying things like, did you know that a helicopter of soldiers 15 years ago on this exact date died. Nobody's talking about them today. Almost like diminishing death. And Stern he pointed out that this isn't a contest. You know, it's not a death contest. And I came across this really good quote from Bernice King. So, mourning a celebrity does not equal a lack of consciousness. And sometimes the death of someone we feel like we knew, but we never actually touch triggers pain about the death of people we knew well. We are on a brief pilgrimage here, reconciling life and death. Love well. I feel like that really simplifies in a lot of ways what we're on this earth doing. We're trying to balance life and death, trying to figure out why certain things happen. And, you know, ultimately some things happen and they just sort of punch you in the gut. And this was one of them. I adore my daughters. And if you listen to this podcast with any sort of regularity or you see me on social media, they are the absolute world to me. And they always have been and they always will be. And so I think maybe part of it is just knowing that Kobe was on this helicopter going to do something with his daughter, that a game that he loved and something that his daughter loves, and they were doing it together. And he was just being a dad. And before I steal some of the lines from this clip that I'm about to play, there is this reporter for ESPN, Elle Duncan, and it was one of the most emotional things that I had heard since the passing when she talked about the story of Kobe. And so I'm going to play this clip, and it's amazing. And it really hits home for me, and I think you'll find out why. So let me just lay out for a second, and let me play this minute and 30-second clip.
It's likely that you're hearing many personal anecdotes about Kobe Bryant, so here's mine. I met Kobe one time, backstage at an event for ESPN in New York, and I saw him and I thought, oh my gosh, that's Kobe. I gotta get a picture for the gram. That's the picture. I didn't get it for a few minutes because as I approached him, he immediately commented on my rather large 8-month pregnant belly. How are you? How close are you? What are you having? A girl, I said, and then he high-fived me. Girls are the best. I asked him for advice on raising girls, seeing as though he quite famously had three at the time. And he said, just be grateful that you've been given that gift because girls are amazing. His third daughter, Bianca, was about a year and a half old at the time. So I asked if he wanted more children. And he said that his wife, Vanessa, really wanted to try again for a boy, but was sort of jokingly concerned that it would be another girl. And I was like, four girls, are you joking? Like, what would you think? How would you feel? And without hesitation, he said, I would have five more girls if I could. I'm a girl dad. When it came to sports, he said that his oldest daughter was an accomplished volleyball player and that the youngest was a toddler, so TBD. But that middle one, he said, that middle one was a monster. She's a beast. She's better than I was at her age. She's got it. That middle one, of course, was Gigi. When I reflect on this tragedy and that half an hour that I spent with Kobe Bryant 2 years ago, I suppose that the only small source of comfort for me is knowing that he died doing what he loved the most, being a dad, being a girl dad.
So there is nothing more on this world that, on this planet that I love more than my kids and more than being a dad. And I think maybe that's why in a lot of ways this has hit me more than other celebrity deaths. And, you know, say what you want about Kobe Bryant and his transgressions 20 years ago and things like that. But I was telling my wife, because there was something that somebody had posted on Instagram the night that Kobe had died. And this person had said something along the lines of, go and call survivors, because people that are accused, people that have gone through a sexual assault and their accusers pass away, oftentimes they're triggered, which I completely have empathy for. However, the whole idea and something that I believe very strongly in, whether somebody committed an act like that or they, God forbid, murdered somebody or they stole something or whatever it is that somebody has done, the whole idea of the justice system, quote unquote, and I have some of my qualms about some of that stuff, is that people can be rehabilitated, right? It's the same thing if somebody has an injury and they go to physical therapy, or somebody has a mental breakdown and they go and they see a psychologist, right? So there's all these different ideas and notions that we have about certain things where something happens to somebody and they can be rehabilitated. And I feel exactly the same way when people commit different acts, regardless of what they are. There are some that people can't come back from. But I think that the fact that since that had happened, there wasn't a blemish on Kobe's record. He has so much respect through the athletic world, but all of his work in the community, all of his work in children's athletics, I mean, in a lot of ways, since he had retired, he's almost lived a bigger life post-retirement. And he's been gone a few years now. So I wanted to make sure that I at least stopped and played that clip from Elle Duncan. I just thought it was so amazing how she talked about that. And I'm a girl dad too, through and through. You know, that's the way that it is. And Dan and I talk quite a bit about parenthood as well. So without further ado, I feel like I'm stealing some of the thunder that Dan and I created. This podcast is awesome. We're going to do a part two at some point. But Dan, like I said, he's practicing in Cleveland now. But most of his clients are people that are remote. So if you get something out of this, I think it's really interesting having a dynamic of a male therapist and me going through this stuff. And maybe that's why the dynamic worked so well. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast week after week. I'm spending some time here and listening to this kind of stuff. So without further ado, here is Dr. Daniel Ratner. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. My name is Eddie Lindenstein. The host, of course. And it's interesting because I feel like I have sort of run the gamut, and just when I feel like I've interviewed every TMS therapist there is, somebody shoots me an email or sends me a DM or something, and they say, you've got to interview this person. And Julie Markowitz, who's been on the show twice, sent me a DM a few weeks ago, and she said, have you ever talked to Dan Ratner? And I said, who's Dan Ratner? And I started doing some background, and Dan Ratner's on the phone now. So that's pretty cool.
Hi. I'm glad to be here with you, Eddie, and thank you for that lead-in.
Julie's big on New York. In fact, I always tell her that now that she moved to the best coast, I say, has your allegiance changed from Notorious B.I.G. to Tupac? And she said, in fact, it has not. So she still has her allegiance to the East Coast, and you have recently relocated to the Midwest. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I actually grew up in the suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio, Shaker Heights, Ohio, and it's my favorite place on earth. And I really wanted to come back and invest in this community. I've been trying to get back here for some time and finally figured out a way to do it. But I will say that I'm Tupac all the way.
Yeah. Oh, I like it. I like it.
His voice are just amazing. I mean, it blows me away.
Yeah. I'm totally with you. And you know, returning home, it's sort of like LeBron leaves, but then Cleveland gets you. So
that's right. That's right. I wrote a letter in Sports Illustrated. It was a little red letter, but
did you in the late 90s? So a really underrated show. My wife, I don't even think my wife had heard of it, and she's 3 years older than me, so that doesn't make any sense. One of my favorite shows when I was a kid was Drew Carey. Did you watch that at all? Because it's Cleveland based.
Yeah, I mean, I watched some of it, but mostly I just felt glad that we had. It's funny, you know, growing up in Cleveland, so many people grew up with a chip on their shoulder here, because you know, in the national media, we could be kind of made fun of. And this will fit into what we'll talk about today. I have a very different feeling being here now because I'm a very different person than I was then, and I feel so much more powerful. And this is a theme that I want to talk about in relation to TMS. When I had 8 years of just excruciating back pain, no answers, and it was a pretty harrowing journey. But making it out from that and understanding how I got out of it and finding my own way out of it gave me a sense of power that just changed me. And now I come back to Cleveland and I'm like, you know what? I don't care who loves Cleveland. I do. It's awesome.
How old were you when you left, did you say?
When I graduated high school, I was 18, and I didn't really want to leave, but everybody was leaving. And I was like, what am I going to do? Hang out here and just miss everybody,
sure.
You know? And so I went on, you know, the kind of adventures people go on, and, not sorry I did that. I do wish I had gotten back here a little sooner, but I'm so glad to be back.
And where did you end up going to school?
I went to Brown University undergrad.
Okay.
And that, you know, it was an interesting ride. It was not a great fit for me in some ways. And I think as we talk about the TMS journey, one thing I can really talk about is the internal journey people go on. And Brown was one of those steps. After Brown, I went, I did Teach for America actually in LA. And so I taught third grade in Compton. And that was a challenging that I wanted a challenge, and that was another point of growth. And in that experience, that was when I thought to myself, I was in a therapy, and I thought to myself, I want to do this work. And so I've been on a journey, and it keeps going.
That is amazing. Third grade in Compton. I mean, I'm from the northern part of California. So I'm not even sure if I've been to I don't think I've ever even driven through Compton, because the time that I was closest to there, because Straight Outta Compton had just come out, and in my wife and I's minds, we're thinking this like ultra volatile place, which it may or it may not be. You know, it depends on how the movie portrays it. But we were with our very young daughter, and she didn't want to do it. And I'm all about, like, I would love to go. I mean, we went to, like, Long Beach isn't the nicest place in a lot of parts of it. Mm-hmm. So, but that's wild. So you went from Cleveland to Brown to Southern California, and then somehow ended up in New York, and then you're back in Cleveland.
Yeah, well, I went to grad school in Philadelphia, and then that's where I met my wife, and we both wanted to go to New York for a while, and Brooklyn was the main place that's where I lived the whole time. She lived in New York first. And then we started raising our kids there, and when we had kids, that was when I was like, can I go home now? You know? It's raising kids. My kids are my favorite thing in the whole world. That won't surprise anyone listening to this, but it's hard. Parenthood is hard. In fact, Sarno said that the number one cause of back pain was having kids. And it's not because you have to pick them up.
Yep.
It's because they you have to give so much of yourself. And that's a big part of what causes symptoms.
How old are your kids?
They are 10 and 6.
And genders?
Oh, two girls.
Hey, me too.
I got two girls. Oh, nice. Yay, girls.
That's what I always tell people. I don't, we don't make boys. It's just like, I don't know how to do it.
And I still don't understand the mindset when people are like, oh, didn't you want to try for a boy? I'm like, why? You know, I mean, I'm all about girls. Yeah. They're the best. No offense.
Right. Yeah. My my best friend, he's got two boys and they're almost exactly the same age as my two girls. And he'll send me these text messages of, you know, they're ruining stuff. They're up all night. They're running around all crazy. And my girls are so calm for the most part. You know, who knows when they're going to be 16 and 13 or 17 and 14, how that'll go.
I mean, girls are so much more mature than boys that, like, you know, a 7-year-old girl is like a 30-year-old boy.
Or a 33-year-old boy in this case. That's awesome. Good. I'm learning more than what the Psychology Today bio told me. That's cool. So you've got a really cool story, and I mentioned off air that one of my favorite things, and I didn't even know this was a thing. So when I started doing this podcast, the first, ironically, I sort of like started at the top in terms of people to interview, because the first two guests that I had in the TMS realm were, or the first three were, Nicole Sachs. And then I had Steve Ozanich on, and people know who he is. And then I had Jeanette Barber, who's from the Rosie O'Donnell Show. And she was she was on the big 2020 special that kind of gave this stuff a lot of notoriety.
Started out slow.
Yeah, started out slow. And as I get more into this, it's so fascinating because there's like, I feel like a lot of people go to school to be psychotherapists at some point, but I've always kind of wondered, what is it that got them there? Why did they want to become a psychotherapist? Like Alan Gordon, who's in Southern California, he's the director of the Pain Psychology Center. He first went to school for economics, and he went and saw the Dalai Lama talk, and he was just kind of like, why do I want to do economics? I feel like I could
I was an economics major at Brown. Actually. then I majored in English also, because it's very easy to double major there.
Yeah.
And you know, when I went there, I checked out psychology first, and all they were doing was kind of lab rats kind of stuff. But yeah. I think that people, this is just my personal theory, but I think people end up either gravitating towards something that really works for them because it's who they are, or they end up stuck away from that. And they're actually trying to get there. So when I work with people, I'm often trying to help them realize who they are at their core. And, you know, who I am at my core is at least part therapist. You know, growing up, I had a lot to contend with, as I'm sure you've heard over and over in these kind of stories. I have a great family, but we went through a lot of really difficult stuff. I'm happy to talk about any of that, by the way. You guide us in that. But, you know, the basic gist is my father died when I was 6 weeks old. And so I grew up with all kinds of complicated emotional experiences that most people don't have. Unfortunately, a lot of people do have something like it. But my mom was very depressed. My brother had a very hard time with it. We had kind of a contentious relationship at various points. And there was a lot to work through in that. And, you know, I think there's kind of a cliche that people talk about with therapists, that they get into this field to fix themselves. And on the one hand, I'll say it's 100% true. It's not the only reason. You know, it's also, I was there kind of being the quiet emotional support for my mom or my brother. And then my mom remarried when I was 3. And, you know, I don't call him my stepfather because he adopted me. So that's another thing I went through, actually, and I can relate to women about. I actually had to change my name when I was 6 years old. And I did not particularly like that. That was hard. So there's all kinds of things about who we are personally. And when it came to searching for what do I want to do, I was always gravitating towards, I genuinely want to help people, which is part of how I got TMS. I'll get into that. I'm sure you're well aware of that by now. You know, I help people all the time, and people with TMS need to learn how to focus themselves and not give too much of themselves so that they just get crushed by life. But I gravitated towards being a therapist, because I wanted to help people who were in similar positions to me. But along the journey, I also helped myself. And TMS actually helped me more than anything, strangely enough. I can just say more about that right now, or we can dive into that later, whatever you think.
We'll probably come back to it, because one thing that's starting to come across my mind is that You know, I got really lucky when I read Sarno's book, and it sort of turned my entire thought and world upside down, because I'm a strength athlete. That's my thing. I do. I compete in weightlifting. I compete in CrossFit. So when all this stuff physically hit me, I mean, that was kind of like and I ride a motorcycle and I ride dirt bikes and all that kind of stuff. So when it hit me, that was really sort of what I thought was going to be the end of my run as an athlete. And when I read Sarno's book, this was sort of like, oh my God, like how did I overlook this? It's easy to say that 2020, but the therapist that I ended up working with, and it was just like, literally, I looked through my insurance guide. I picked what's the closest distance. This guy had the most reviews, was the highest rated. And I worked with him for, I don't know, 7 or 8 months, and then he retired. He happened to know all about Sarno, knew all about this stuff. And he wasn't like a TMS therapist per se, but he treated in that way. And so I got very lucky. But yeah, my assumption after he had retired is that every therapist knows about TMS, and this is kind of all how they treat. And then I find that's not really the case.
Not only is it not really the case, it's not even close to the case, unfortunately.
Right. And so I guess that would be a good launching off point to where your pain or illness issues or symptom issues or you know, whatever those may be. When did those start, and what were they?
Okay. So, I mean, I started with the kind of classic Sarno back pain. I say started, but actually when I look back on it, I had a whole lifespan of symptoms. That's also probably a theme you've heard over time. I had symptoms. It's just that they were kind of more transient, or the first chronic symptom I had was back pain. And that began when I was 28. Now, my father died when he was 29. So it was not lost on me, the timing, right away. But this is one of the amazing things about TMS, is you can know certain links, and yet it doesn't do anything if you don't understand that this is really true. And it has to make sense to you for you to believe it's true. And meanwhile, we have the whole world telling us otherwise. The entire world. I mean, when I discovered Sarno, I was like, am I living in an alternate universe? What? Because it made sense to me, but I couldn't understand, why did no one know about this? Let me take you through just briefly what that all was like for me, and feel free to ask any questions you want if I don't answer something. But it began, you know, with like a little twinge in my back. I was reaching over to tie my shoes. And I remember thinking, you know, oh God, I'm getting inflexible. I'm getting older. It kind of cracks me up.
At 28.
At 28, I had that thought. I'm now 45. So, but I feel younger now than I did then in a lot of ways. So, but that fear right there is a really important like germ of an idea that I didn't think at the time, but that worry is part of the TMS process. And I started worrying, you know, maybe this will get worse. And lo and behold, it did. And it got significantly worse. And it was probably just a couple months later that I started having these wrenching back spasms. And they were, to this day, the most painful thing I've ever experienced. I often say to people, you know, they'll say to me, how can this be TMS? It hurts so much. And I say, no. The fact that it hurts that much is a sign it is TMS. Nothing has hurt worse than TMS. These I would have these spasms. They'd wake me up every night, just wrenching pain, like I was being snapped in half, or like I was being electrocuted, and I would scream from them. And they were happening more and more, and they started extending further into my day. And it got to the point where, you know, I was a therapist, but every time I would sit down for more than 5 minutes, when I would get up, I would have a spasm. And so, you know, the end of the session, here I am trying to give the person I'm working with some confidence that I can help them. I didn't exactly want to get up and have a wrenching spasm. They'd be like, what's wrong with you? You know, are you okay? I wanted to be taking care of them. So I'd get up and just silently like flinch.
Yep.
And it was affecting everything. I get afraid of everything. I gave up basketball. I played basketball almost every day for you know, well over a decade at that point. And I just, well, now I have to be careful. I've injured my back. I was thinking about injury. And this is what we naturally think about because this is what we're told. We're told herniated discs cause back pain. You know, told that arthritis causes pain. So it's all about aging and structures. And so with that in mind, I thought, okay, well, I guess I better go to the doctor. So I went to a doctor, and a doctor that was recommended to me by my uncle, who is a doctor, and he's never steered me wrong. So I thought, okay, this will be okay. You know, doctors can help. I go in, and this was a big, big shock. Doctors not only couldn't help, they seemed to have no idea what was going on. And even worse, they didn't know that they had no idea. So the kind of feedback I was getting were things like, oh yeah, you probably have a structural injury. And I remember saying to this doctor, so am I going to have back pain for the rest of my life? Get ready for what she said. She said, probably.
Wow.
And she said it in that tone. I was like, are you gleeful about this? What's happening? And there was no follow-up answer. So I was like, this is really weird. So then I went to get an MRI, and many, many people tell me that they always hope there's a diagnosis. They're desperate for a diagnosis. They want to know what's wrong and how can I be helped. So I went into this MRI thinking, I sure as hell hope I don't have a tumor, you know. Or I was very worried about whatever it might be, but I also, at the back of my mind, was thinking, what if it's nothing? What if there's nothing, you know? And ultimately, that's what happened. I got an MRI, and it was totally clean. So I was like, well, this is really weird. And the weirdest part for me was that medicine not only didn't know, but they actually didn't even seem interested.
So what's the explanation from the doctor when the MRI is clean? What's the explanation for your pain at that point?
Oh, that is a great question, because I find myself wondering why aren't they more curious about what that means then? Often they just say, like, you know, some people just have a genetic predisposition for back pain, or they'll give some kind of almost, I'd say, random theory. Yep. That just doesn't explain anything. Or they might say, you know, MRIs pick up most big things, but maybe you have a slight tear or something. We can send you to an expert who can read this better. And you know, that, or they might say the age old argument of maybe your core has gotten weak. You know, we'll send you to a physical. Bless you. So, you know, to me, looking back on it now, they're hilariously grasping at straws. It's not hilarious for the sufferer, but it's really interesting to look back and see how much they're grasping at straws. So what happened was they sent me to a physical therapist, and he said it was my core, you know, and we worked on exercises. And what I found was when he would kind of manipulate the back, it actually would feel better. So I was like, well, there's definitely something physically going on, you know, for sure. This is physically real. Because I had a friend who said, oh, you know, it's all in your head. He had heard about Sarno on Howard Stern and misunderstood it, because it's not all in your head. It's from your head, but it's real in the body. But I didn't know that at the time. I went to the physical therapist. It wasn't helping either. They sent me to a back pain specialist, and this was the weirdest experience of all. I went in, and the guy starts talking about my symptoms into a dictaphone, and he's just looking at me while he's doing it. And I'm like, is this all we're doing? What? it was really weird. And at the end, he said, so yeah, I don't know what's wrong. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, you are a back pain expert. It's okay to not know something. But what I didn't understand was he was fine not knowing. That was the weirdest part. Well, you know, like, If I'm a back pain expert, I'm not going to be fine not knowing. I'm going to be like, let's figure this out. What is going on? You know, but he gave me no explanation. And I just kind of stood there, and I was like, so I guess I should leave. And he was like, have a good day.
You know, one thing that makes me think about is, so there's a Netflix documentary that was released recently, and it got a lot of press. It was very popular. Are you like a Netflix documentary guy at all or no?
Yeah, sure.
So there's one that was called Unbelievable, which came out recently, which is really like the story. There's a couple of women who were sexually assaulted. There was a case in Colorado. There was a case in Washington. And the case in Washington was about, I mean, I probably lived a mile and a half from where that rape occurred at the time it occurred. That was a part of this documentary. And the investigators for the local police department, I mean, these were guys that it's like they didn't want to know, kind of what you're describing with the doctor. And I feel like it's pretty easy on the outside to say that a police officer that has the facts, somebody in front of them is saying, hey, this thing happened to me. And they sort of have this ambivalence like, nah, you know, I'm okay with not knowing. Right. You would say that person is a bad detective. That person's a bad cop. But right. It seems like with the grasping at straws and the really no idea, nobody will make that leap to say this person's a, I mean, it sounds shitty to say. Like, I have a tough time even saying it. This person's a bad doctor. But if they're not willing to investigate, then what good are they? What good is it?
I totally agree with you. That's my delineation. I want to be clear. You know, the medical community can be wonderful. They've done so many great things. So I say this not to malign doctors, but I do draw the line at when you're not curious about your own work. I think you're right. I think that's the distinction.
So you have this, I mean, you're starting to get the cascade of uninformation or no information, and somehow you make your way to figuring or to, I guess somebody makes a suggestion about Dr. Sarno's books, or maybe you search on Amazon. How does that happen?
Well, that was the thing, and was one of the scariest things, is it was pretty random. You know, I had gone to see a chiropractor for many years, and he had gotten it to a point where it wasn't spasming so much. And we had gotten me off of taking all this Advil. And so I was doing better, but I still didn't have any answers. It's hard to have a mystery of that proportion about what's going on with you and why, and have no answers. And everybody I knew was asking me about it all the time. They were like, you know, what's going on with your back? And I was like, I don't know. I can't tell you. And I would find, you know, some kind of solution that helped a little bit, but none of it made sense to me. So the randomness of it is what scares me for all the people who are suffering, because, and this is why I want to get the message out, everybody needs to know about this, not because necessarily it's right for everybody or it's the only way, but because if it isn't factored in, for the people who need it, they may not find it. So what happened to me is I was seeing the chiropractor for a long time, and I think eventually, to his credit, he was curious about what he was doing. And he thought, I don't know why this isn't getting fully better. And he had heard about Sarno. So he said, well, you might try this book. And I thought to myself, oh, crap. I have sunk to a new low. I'm going to read a book that's supposed to help me with back pain. I was just like, but anyone who's had TMS will tell you they do almost anything to make the pain stop. It was excruciating. It was making me feel like my life was not worth living. And it was 8 years of it. So I said, okay, I'll read a book. I don't have any problem with that. But, you know, it was kind of random. I even ended up at the chiropractor randomly. I was talking to a colleague and I heard her say that she had had back pain. And I heard that past tense. And I was like, had back pain? What? Well, it was like maybe the Holy Grail was out there, you know. And she recommended this chiropractor, and that's how I ended up hearing about Sarno eventually. But that took years, even with somebody who knew about it. And literally no one in my life knew about Sarno except for the one guy who had listened to Howard Stern, and he misunderstood it entirely.
I was listening to Stern just this morning. I got a new car, and so I get 4 months of Sirius XM, and like, I had not listened to Stern in the post Sarno, like the post TMS days. So now knowing, I mean, I would say there's probably 15 people that I've interviewed on here that say that they heard him talk about it. And I know that he's a very well-known figure, and he says that Sarno is his personal hero, you know, more than anybody out in the world. And, I was listening to him this morning, and he was talking about how agitated, there was a couple of callers that had kind of made, you know, they were just obnoxious. They were just kind of being obnoxious, I think, just to get some attention. And he pointed out that he's very agitated right now. And he had just said, my back and neck and shoulders are killing me. And he goes, but I know all this stuff psychosomatic anyway. And I was just thinking, like, if I didn't know any better, I would probably, I may like Google, what does that even mean? And hopefully it would say, you know, Sarno coming up. But like, kudos to Stern. Like, he's a big figure and people may think he's nuts if he says things like that. But, you know, just like with what you're describing, so many people have gotten this avenue because of this dude on the radio.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting. I was meeting with a TMS psychologist. I won't mention any names, but he said, I was saying, you know, I feel like I have to spread this message. And he said, I understand you want to proselytize. And I was like, no, proselytizing is different. When you're spreading the word of science, that is not proselytizing. There's real science behind this, and we need to spread the message. But I certainly share Howard Stern's view. Dr. Sarno is one of my all-time heroes, if not number one, because he changed my life. And he changed my life with his curiosity.
I mean, by some way of the universe, he died 2.5 days before I found his book.
Wow.
Which is correct, because when I first found it, and then I finished it in a, you know, in a day or whatever, and then I look him up on Wikipedia and see that he had just passed away, and I'm like, what are the odds on the timing? But to me, like, it seems like nobody knows about this stuff, but then when I just look at like Amazon reviews, and between his four books, there's like 3,000-4,000 reviews, and it's like 4.8 or 4.9 out of 5 stars, which is not an easy feat in the book world for how critical people on the internet always are. But now, like, you know, hindsight is everything, of course. But when I now, because maybe I'm seeking the information, or the information is maybe just more out there. But even studies, like, there's one out there that says that 70% of people walking around right now with no pain have a disc herniation. And to me, right. I feel like, even if I didn't know who Sarno was, I would want to know more about that.
Absolutely. And I also think we've made a lot of progress since my back pain. You know, it's been 9 years since I've had any significant back pain. And when I do have a flare up, I can generally make it go away very quickly. Occasionally it might, you know, bite me for a couple of days and then I'll find my way back. But, you know, there's a lot of information coming out, and I think curiosity is the key, because people are, you know, when they hear something like that, they're like, well, how does that fit with reality? We can't ignore evidence. We can't. You know, I'm not saying I know everything about what's going on, but I'm not going to ignore any evidence.
Right.
If we do that, we're not doing a good job. And so I'm pleased, and I think it. This movement is kind of picking up steam, and I appreciate you doing your part in it.
I'm just a fan. So you read this book. Are you better overnight, or it's not like that?
Well, that's part of the reason I ended up developing kind of my own method is, no, I wasn't better overnight, but it did start to change overnight. And that was very compelling evidence. I was like, nothing has changed except I read a book. Now it's shifting around. It was lesser at certain times. It also started to make sense of the data I had seen over 8 grueling years, you know, that I wasn't always as bad at different times. It would come and go, and I didn't understand what the meaning was, but, you know, the data had to make sense somehow. There is a reality. So it started getting better. What happened for me is that I read a book called Mind Over Back Pain, which was Sarno's first book, and it's kind of his most slimmed down version of it, which I recommend to people who don't really love to read so much, because it really gets the job done. But then I read The Divided Mind, which is his last book, and it is a much more in-depth look. And the thing that I have found is it's very key when you're trying to get better from TMS. It has to make sense to you. And that's going to be different with each person. And I think this is part of the problem we face as a society, is we're always trying to make everything fit into some cookie cutter idea. Well, we're individuals and we have individual brains, and our brains are the most powerful computers that have ever been created anywhere. And I sometimes laugh when people are like, oh, I'm worried that technology will take over, you know, Skynet. Those computers are the dumbest computers compared to our brains. It's like by a factor of like a million, at least, probably more.
My computer teacher in high school used to always say, computers are stupid. You need to tell them what to do. He's like, people aren't necessarily like that. And I always thought it was such a strange comment from a computer teacher to say, but you're totally right.
Well, I think he knew enough to know.
Yep.
So, you know, our brains are really powerful and they all have a unique story and a unique way of understanding it. So when I work with people, I don't have a cookie cutter method. I have lots of different methods because different things are going to work for different people. And when I embark on working with somebody on this stuff, we often kind of invent the work together. I utilize my experience with myself to say, hey, this worked for me. What do you think? There are plenty of times where they're like, no, that wouldn't work for me. And they're right. And then there are other times where they say, oh my God, that really unlocked something for me. I had not thought about it that way. That makes sense to me. It has to make sense to the listener.
Well, that brings up an interesting question. So give me an example. Give me maybe two different quote unquote techniques or ways that you may go about treating that are kind of on opposite ends of each other. And maybe this will help for color, but I get, I don't know, 10 emails a week-ish from just a mix of people. They could be people that are fully healed, or they could be people that are in the most painful of moments. But
yeah,
they could be 20-year-old female with, no kids and no significant other and, you know, not really, you would perceive not a care in the world. But then I also hear from the 30-year-old male that has two or three kids and a job and a mortgage and all this kind of stuff. So, but it seems like their pain can exist in the exact same spot, be equally as intense. And I would imagine you may treat those kind of people different. So give me a couple of examples of different ways that you may treat that are not so similar.
Okay, well, your question is a great one, and it happens to fit right with kind of how I think about things because the treatment I developed was because I used Sarno as a springboard, but it wasn't everything. It had to make sense to me, and I had to figure out my own way. And I actually talked to Sarno once on the phone. He was retired at the time, but he was coming into the office every 2 weeks, and I got to talk to Sarno before he died. And it ended up being a pretty profound conversation, but not in the way I expected at all. And it was initially disappointing. I said to him, I described what was happening. I said his books seemed to be helping me more, but I kind of needed to, it felt like if I could just meet with him, he could help me understand some things. And he said, well, why don't you just work on it yourself? And I was like, what? No!
Right.
Because at that time, I was still looking for, understandably, guidance from somebody else, and he was the closest thing I had to anything that could help me. But as I started working on it, I started finding my way. And here's what I found for myself. Pain comes from two different sources. It can come from emotional life. Well, I shouldn't say that. Pain can come from a crane getting dropped on you. I'm just talking about the TMS symptoms. That can come from the emotional world, when you don't know about something painful in the very way that Sarno describes, you can defend against knowing about it through a symptom. But there's a whole other side, and I had to find through my own thinking, which is, it's a side that I call doubt. Some people prefer to have it called fear or questions, or there's all kinds of things. But if you have lingering questions, TMS has room to play. So when I work with doubts, I help people bring out the questions that they actually have, the reasons that they aren't certain it's TMS, because certainty about TMS is part of the cure. And I don't want that to sound cultish. In fact, quite the opposite. It is all about science and logic. If it doesn't make full sense to you, then it won't work fully. So sometimes I'm looking for an emotion, and I have kind of a rules of thumb about it. One rule of thumb, for example, is that the timing of the symptom always matters. It's not random. Nothing is random. theories that depend on randomness are not good theories. If your symptom popped up and you were talking to somebody, but you think nothing was going on, I can guarantee you something was going on right there. The onset of a new symptom is always emotional.
You're saying, like, this is a good example. A buddy of mine, who he co-leads, we have a pretty large Facebook group all about TMS. There's probably 3,000 people in it. And him and I ironically live 10 miles apart, but the bulk of these people are, you know, they're all around the country and the world. He puts a lot of insightful posts out to kind of make people think a little bit more. He's also kind of like a no-nonsense, no-bullshit kind of. There's a couple of... It seems like for people that are in roles like ours, we're like, we're just fans of this stuff and we went through it. It's either like kind of the no nonsense, no BS approach, which when I read accounts of Sarno, that's kind of seems where he is. And then there's sort of the other kind of more, I don't know if touchy feely is the right thing, but, you know, highly sympathetic, highly, you know what I mean? Like that kind of, he posted this thing the other day and he said he was doing these heavy deadlifts and he had a twinge and he said that he had stopped himself in the moment and had recognized that he was having a thought about something in the past as well as things that were maybe going to happen in the future, and that was enough to curb it. And that sounds like what you're talking about with timing meaning everything.
Very much. And sometimes you can stop the symptom in the moment, but sometimes you can understand the symptom and learn something from it. And then you carry it to your next experience of symptoms. I can make most symptoms go away in under 10 seconds. You know, little things like I'm lying in bed and one of my kids calls me and I get up and my heel is killing me. And I immediately think I'm mad that I have to deal with this. I don't want it. You know, I let myself have that and I don't interpret the symptom any other way. So yeah, that's part of what I do. And that part I think has a lot of overlap with people. What I found has less overlap is this doubt side of things. I read David Schechter's book, I think it's called Think Away Your Pain, and he mentions doubt. He's one of the only people I've found, and I've done a lot of reading, but I haven't read everything, but he talks about doubt. But he doesn't talk about it as much as I actually am writing a book now. And it's precisely for this reason. People want to know the steps that I went through, or they want to know suggestions. People are so desperate for help, and understandably so. So my book actually is all about the full convincing argument of why I believe in TMS. I feel like it's a gap in the literature out there, where there's lots of books that can help and do help, but my book is targeting anybody who has any doubt about it. My goal is by the end of reading my book, they won't have any.
Schechter had on this very podcast, I remember he sort of started soapboxing. He said what, I don't remember how he transitioned into it, but he said, what is doubt? And he said, doubt is everything. And it was three or four straight minutes of him talking about doubt.
Yeah, right. He's, there's certain people in this community that are so amazing. And I feel like David Schechter bringing that doubt side of things is wonderful. Howard Schubiner is fantastic for so many reasons. But he actually combines the two sides you were talking about, you know, with touchy-feely or no-nonsense, because he is such a warm person from any interactions I've had with him, even though they've been brief. But he also is so logical, and it's all science. And he's driven a lot of the science. So then this is a very talented community, and I'm proud to be part of it. And I want to add my part. And I think I'm very in line with what David Schechter's probably said about doubt. I think that it is a massive part of things. I actually think it's far bigger than the emotional aspect. The emotional aspect is key to getting us to see what's really happening. But the emotion doesn't last. The symptom often does. And to disable the symptom that has lasted, you need to annihilate any doubt.
So that's maybe, this is something we could probably do a 6-hour episode on how you sort of overcome that.
Let's do that.
Well, before this is over, I'm going to ask you to commit to another episode, but we don't have to do that right now. Verbal contracts, but
I'm already in, but go ahead.
Yeah. but you know, that it's an interesting thing. Like Schumacher, for instance, I've heard him say that basically the more symptoms, because he kind of does a little bit of a doubt annihilation in a way, or doubt termination, as long as you mentioned Skynet earlier. But he says, like, the more symptoms that you've had, the more likely that this is. And in fact, he continuously would make the statement that the investigation's over, or put your investigation hat away. And it would be like, the more symptoms you have, or the more symptoms that occur at a time, or basically the more specialists that you've seen that don't have so there was exactly. All these things where, I mean, I thought when I was going to interview him that he was going to be very much 50-50, 50% in the realm of this could be physical, or 50% in the realm of this. And I saw it more as like 95-5 psychological side, the interpretation I had based on what he was talking about.
Yeah. And it's so important that, you know, medical doctors saying that is particularly important. I found it very important that Star was a medical doctor. You know, I'm a psychologist, but I don't want you just to take it from me. Take it from medicine. These things are in the New England medicine. It's everywhere. This is science. This is facts. And we keep gathering the data. And I would say 95-5 sounds about right to me.
I know what I did, but if you were to have somebody consult with you or work with you, and they said, you know, they started having some doubt and felt like the initiation of different symptoms, a variety of things. Let's say that they have a history of IBS and they have a history of back pain and they have all these kind of things, but they feel that the onset of those is very random, like that they can't tie anything to it. Yeah. What's sort of the first step that you would use when it comes to logic and doubt to have them overcome that? That it's not just a random sequence of events. What would you tell them to do or think about?
I feel that in a way this answer is incredibly lame, but it's important. The answer is always depends.
Yeah.
It's not a very satisfying answer.
You're right. But that is lame.
I'm sorry. But I'm going to elaborate. You know, I'm going to come back and say more about what depends and where to go. So this is... The short answer is very unsatisfying. The long answer is. But I would say that, you know, the first step I do is an assessment with the person of, okay, what are you thinking about this? How? Why are you doubting this? So, for example, some people might say, well, I don't think anything was going on because this was going on. And I'm like, say more about that. And then we hear more about it. And it's like, no, you thought nothing was going on, but something was. For some people, I have to have a discussion about the nature of unconscious psychology. There are people who don't believe that the unconscious exists, so maybe that's where I need to start. Then there are people who are like, no, I totally believe in that. I just, you know, I don't think there was anything going on in this issue. Well, maybe with that person, I might need to look at why did you think that wasn't, you know, a charged moment? Because it sounds like it is to me. And there are times where I will also look around and think, I don't hear anything in it either. So maybe we're not going to get to the bottom of that. The good news I find is you don't have to get to the bottom of the emotion. Because once the emotion is passed, you're dealing with doubt. So then you start to go to doubt. Okay, what's making you doubt this? Is it, I don't know the science behind it. Okay, well, I can point you in the right direction about that. I can tell you about these different studies. Is it... doubt comes in many forms, by the way. So another form of doubt is, no, I believe in Sarno. I believe this is TMS. But at base, they don't believe that they can conquer it. They don't believe they're good enough. They don't believe they're strong enough or that they can overcome fear. So then sometimes I'm working in that way. So hopefully that's a much more satisfying answer than depends, because that gives you multiple types of things that I work on. Depending on where that is. Did that answer your question?
It does, and it brings up another one, though. And one thing that I have a tough time... No, luckily, nobody's ever asked me, well, explain this to me, Eddie, because I don't know what I would say. But maybe you can give me something I can say. So there's... Sarno always... So it used to be on YouTube. It's sold on his website, but I've heard mixed reviews about people actually even receiving the items that they're ordering. But there's like a legacy website of his where it is he recorded his lecture... for distribution. I don't know when he would have done this. Based on the hairstyles that are in the audience of it, I think it was probably in the mid to late 90s, but I could be wrong. But he says it a whole bunch of times, but he explains the unconscious part of it, and that basically these thoughts and emotions are sort of under the surface and they're never going to come out and you're never going to be able to access them. At the same time, you know, doing things like journaling or even trying to think about, say that the example earlier, my buddy Brad, who does a heavy deadlift, feels a twinge, and then recognizes that he was thinking about something that was in his past as well as maybe getting anxious about things in the future. That's a very conscious thing. So what camp are you on, or is it a blend of both where it's like, to me, it feels very disempowering to say this stuff is all under the surface and so you're never going to know what it is.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because I actually don't think this is far from the surface. I don't think this is hard to discover usually. One thing that I do is I kind of map out the kind of themes to look for so that people aren't just wandering around aimlessly looking for things. I can tell what kinds of themes matter. They're always big themes. They might come in little forms. But, you know, if your friend was worrying about mortality, for example, at some level, that's a big theme that fits with TMS. And maybe it came in the form of, oh, I don't know where I'll be in 10 years. But really, somewhere in there, you were headed towards mortality, you know. So there are themes we can map out. This is part of what I do in Disabling Doubt, is that I show the types of themes so you can kind of think about this. But I'm not all in one camp, but I what I do is I lay out all the different factors. Triggers are another factor. What I mean by that is a physical event that is very believable for an injury. So if you're weightlifting and you happen to be having an emotion, you could have that trigger so that you get a quote unquote injury. But injuries all heal. Our minds and bodies blow me away. Like they heal fast. If you heal from a broken bone in 12 weeks at most, if we can do that, we shouldn't have back pain for 8 years. That does not make sense. And it doesn't make sense from an evolutionary perspective either. We evolved for millions of years so that we could be cripples at 28. I don't think so. That does not sound right to me.
Yep.
So you asked, am I of any particular camp in it? I guess what I would say is I think there is a comprehensive way of understanding TMS, and I think the community as a whole is fit. We fit together in ways that are bringing different pieces of the puzzle. I'm trying with my book to show that to look at it from all angles, and which is a tricky thing to do in a book that anyone would want to read, because currently it's 800 pages and I need to cut it down to at least 400. It's got to be below 400. You know, I'll get it there. But I'm just writing everything first. And I think it's because part of the puzzle that I think is missing is I'd like to expand on David Schechter's idea of doubt, which I already had. And then I was very pleased to see that he had added too, independently and before me.
What I know we're at the top of the hour. I know you had said we could dribble on for a little bit longer, but do you have 15 to 20 minutes in you additional?
Yeah. Okay. No, let's do it.
I'm trying to think about, there's so many things and so many notes I'm rattling away here. And I just know that, I mean, for sure a part two, maybe even a part three. So one thing that I'm thinking about is, and these are going to go wildly out of order. So before we even do a part two, I'm going to have to re-listen to this and think about the things that I forgot or didn't say. You mentioned earlier about kids. You had kids. So tell me about the impact of that, because I mean, you said that your oldest kid is 10, and so you would have been 35, but you 28 was kind of when you discovered this stuff, right? So there's a 7 year gap. And so how, now that you can be the person that's observing, you know, again, 2020 hindsight is everything, but seeing the impact of kids on your life when it comes to things like symptoms or the way that you think about things or the way that your certain things are triggered, like just, I guess, you know, jump up on the soapbox and tell me a little bit about when it comes to parenting and children. And, because I mean, to give you an idea, one of the things that removed a lot of doubt for me initially was making literally a timeline of symptom and then what was going on right around that time. Like, let's say in the few days before. Sometimes it's really hard because it might be 15 years ago, so remembering. But the first really, not crippling thing, but pretty debilitating thing was this rapid, sudden onset of a really severe allergic reaction to dairy products for me. That was kind of the first one that really knocked me on my ass because, again, in strength sports and all this kind of stuff, it's like you're very reliant on things like whey protein. I also love things like frozen yogurt, right? And there's like, there's a lot of things there. And then suddenly, overnight, there was no... You know, there was nothing that was happening prior to it physically where it was like, oh, you're starting to get a little bit of a reaction. It was like it made me sick to my stomach, needing to throw up, like terrible. And when I sat down and I made this list, my wife and I found out that we were pregnant with our first child. It was like 48 hours before this thing started.
Wow.
So that was kind of the first, like, I'm beginning to be Eminem battle rapping the free world at the end of 8 Mile, right? Now I'm starting to, like, I'm going to start saying things before they're even occurring and sort of punch this thing into the ground. Because now the list was getting huge, and it was like I was starting to see knee tendonitis issues, shoulder issues, back problems, spasms, all this kind of thing. I was able to start tying a lot of this stuff together. So tell me about parenthood and TMS.
Okay, your questions are fantastic, by the way. They're so right on to what we need to be talking about. I want to say one thing before getting to parenthood, though. Tying a symptom to an emotional event, even just once, is life-changing. You know, and it's like what you said. Once you see that, there's nothing more convincing than that. And that's part of what happened for me when I started getting better. I was working with a therapist at the time, and it was kind of a contentious relationship, actually. The only therapist I worked with that was like that at any point. I got a lot out of it, actually, but not always through him. and he was going on vacation for a week, and my back pain got so much worse. And I thought to myself, come on, this cannot be about that. Who cares? It's a week. And I did not believe that could be what it would be. He didn't even suggest that at the time, but I was wondering about it, and I was like, it can't be. Well, a couple months later, he went away for the month, and the back pain started within 10 minutes of our last session. And that really was a game changer for me. I was like, TMS is for sure real. So I just wanted to say that. Now, let me jump to parenthood, because this is a very important topic for me and for many people. I'm sure they experience parenthood in all sorts of ways. I have a very personal take on it, but I think really fits with my TMS model. And you're so right that every TMS practitioner, I think, has their own way of thinking about it. But for me, having kids, you know, it's life-changing for everybody. But for me, I didn't know what my biological father felt about me. He was gone when I was 6 weeks old. And I remember with our first kid, she was 6 weeks old, and I looked at her and I thought, I love her so much that it was so relieving to me, because I was like, he must have loved me. And I didn't know that. I truly did not know that until that moment. I was 35 years old. That was the first moment I thought that my biological father loved me in any way. And then with our second kid, when she was 6 weeks old, I looked at her and I thought, and I'm the second kid, by the way. So I was curious what I felt about the second kid. And sadly, what I thought was, I'll get to you soon. I love her every bit as much. But then I knew what was coming. I knew where it was going. It was just different. So I kind of undid some of my gains in relation to my father. But I will say this. My kids, I love them in a way that I don't love anyone else. And they love me in a way that I've never been loved. And so, especially with my first kid, I that was where I kind of learned the lesson. With the second kid, it wasn't as much of a surprise, but she loved me in a way that made me feel like, oh, this is why I've been having emotional pain. I have not felt loved like this. And that doesn't mean that somebody else should love you like your child loves you, but I think sometimes parenthood brings to light what our experiences were like growing up and what was missing or what felt lacking, whether it was or wasn't. It could be just how it felt. So I think parenthood can be very healing, even though it can also be very challenging. But the main thing that I wanted to say about it is that the way that it healed me is to make me feel like I could be powerful. And the TMS experience mirrored that. You know, as a parent, my kids look at me and I'm like one of the gold standards of how you're supposed to live. That's a very powerful feeling and very moving. And, you know, we can feel very responsible. We can feel very worried. These things can cause symptoms. But the one of the major plus sides is we can feel more powerful. And that's what I came out of when I conquered back pain through Sarno's help and then through my own work. You know, I had some help along the way, but really those were the main things in the end. I started to feel like I could do something that most people can't do and most people don't know about. And it was mind blowing. I felt like I had been given a window into like Newton discovering gravity. I was like, this is life changing. And I think parenthood is a similar type of thing. It's life changing in a love sort of way, but both gave me a sense that I could be something bigger than I thought that I ever could be. And I don't know, that's my main feeling about parenthood as it affected me personally.
What about one thing that I'm thinking of, because that's not the avenue, that's not the direction at all I thought you were going to go with that, which is good. Those are good. Those are good things. Yeah. And my buddy Ken, who is, I think he's 13 years older than me. So he's older than you too. And one thing that he told me when my buddy Pete and I, so like we're like the trio of, we're the boys, right? We're the guys. Pete and I we didn't become pregnant, but you know what I mean. Our significant others became pregnant within 2.5-ish months of each other. So we're going to have our first kids at the same time, essentially. Both going to have daughters, which was cool. Ken told us, we went out for a happy hour or something, and Ken had already had two kids that were, you know, he'd had several years of time. I think at the time they were probably, I don't know, the boy's probably 7, the girl's probably 4 or 5. So like he has some mileage on him as a parent. He had said, your life's about to get a lot better in a really weird way.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a great description.
It is such a great description. And I've been like, I remember on my way home once, my daughter, I can hear her in the back and her stomach is rumbling in her car seat. She diarrhea all over herself, literally neck to the bottom of her rain boots. And I was like, I don't know why, because we weren't that far from home, but I was like, we need to go. Oh, I needed to go to Best Buy to get something. And I was like, so I can take this kid in or I can skip it and come back tomorrow. And I took the kid in and I'm watching her walk 3 or 4 feet in front of me. And she's got literally like, I can see it seeping into her boots. And I'm thinking, this is so pun shitty. But this is going to be like the funniest story for the longest time. Right. So like in a way it's a stupid situation, but it was something that had made me laugh. And I'm like, yeah, like that just totally enhanced the stories I can tell for 50 years.
And it changes your perspective on everything. But I was curious, where did you think I was going with it?
I thought that it was going to go in a way that, I hear so many other stories, myself included, is that, it's almost like life felt so easy and then you have kids and then life gets a lot harder. And so then symptoms get worse and here's why. That's what I thought that was going to go. Yeah,
and that's totally true. It's not my central take though on parenthood for, I think not only for personal reasons, but for other reasons. Being powerful is a key part of not having doubt. So it's actually a key part of my treatment is to help people become powerful and feel permission to be powerful. But raising kids is very important for multiple reasons, but one of them in relation to TMS is it does shed light on just how many kind of primitive feelings we can have of just not wanting to have to do certain things. It's very, very hard. It's the best thing I've ever done, and it was the hardest thing I've ever done. And you know, my kids now are at an age that's so much easier, and I I have less symptoms, but some of that, this is good news I give to pain sufferers. Just because you're going through a lot of emotional stuff doesn't mean you're doomed to have the pain.
Yeah, so that's an important distinction, and the timing's great. And I say the timing's great just because I've had this conversation a lot, I feel like, lately with people that will email me or people that I'm responding to on a message board or something like that. And I think that a lot of times maybe this is rooted in Sarno's, I think in the mind body prescription was the first time he brought it up, but the soothe to rage ratio, this whole idea that you can balance these two things. And to me, I understand it. However, I think that it can be this is going to sound really dramatic, but almost like a dangerous precedent, because to me, what it implies is that if you have a quote unquote highly stressful life, which is each to their own, but let's say that somebody has they've got a full-time job and they've got kids and they take their kids to school and they get their lunches ready and they do, they make dinner and they do all these things that, like, they're trying to fit all this 24-hour stuff in one day, and they need to be able to sleep and they need to be able, all this kind of stuff. And so they'll try and balance that with going and getting a facial for an hour, a massage for 1 hour. And they kind of say this self-care. And it's almost like they feel like they can sort of balance out all the stress they feel in their life with doing some kind of an external thing to, to teeter-totter this stress. And I feel like that's like trying to chase a Ferrari when you're driving a Ford Pacer, right? So like, So I guess what would you have to say about that? Like the idea of people trying to do this balancing act of like they have all this stressful stuff and they're going to try and balance it out with stuff that quote unquote will de-stress them.
Yeah, I think it's such a great point. So one thing I'll say is sometimes that is needed. Sometimes people just aren't giving themselves enough and they could, and it makes a big difference. So I am all for that type of self-care. I think that this is a funny thought to add to the equation. I think sometimes people take that too far and then they start not doing the things that they need to do. So we do have to balance it. But here's the thing that I think primarily, it's all about what it all means inside of you. You know, you could go ahead and do that external thing, but spend the entire time feeling guilty about it or hating yourself for some reason. And then what good is it? So it's all about what the meaning is for you. And I think that people, this is a big part of the work that I do separate from TMS, but also related to TMS, because I, was a therapist for many, many years before that. Before I started this work, and I still do work that sometimes isn't TMS related, I find that people have to connect to what things mean for them inside. It's just like the TMS treatment is all about, okay, where are your doubts? I can't resolve this without working with you specifically in your specific mind. Well, the same is true in terms of what's going on and what's stressful. Sometimes people can get stressed about seemingly very small things, but they're not small, not in them. You know, maybe somebody getting mad at you at a grocery store is a very small thing, but maybe that sends them reeling for days because they're hard on themselves. So it's stress. I think the point I love that I feel like you were making is that external stress is not the solution. Reducing external stress is good and nice, and we need to work for that balance. But reducing internal stress is the key. And that usually relates to your relationship with yourself. And we all, that's a hard one to manage.
One, maybe a really good example, because this just happened this morning, because I had, I do the ungodly work of CrossFit and weightlifting at 6 a.m. And shout out to everybody that does that with me. It is nice because the Fitbit says that I've burned like 1,300 calories by the time I get home at 7:00 or 7:30.
That's Yeah, a good head start. I don't do much of anything at 6. I have to get up to go to the bathroom, and then I just go back to sleep if I can.
I'm very much an early riser, but I am not exciting on the weekends. So
I'm a total night owl. I'll stay up as long as I can.
Yeah, 9:30, I'm about out on a Friday. So that's where you'll find me tonight at 9:30. But so this morning, one thing that I've been thinking a lot about lately, it's not like, so I'm 33. It's not like I'm past my, I'll be 34 in March. It's not like I'm by any means past my physical prime. However, I feel very differently, you know, speed wise, cardiovascularly, all that kind of stuff from when I was like 27. I'm a shit ton stronger now as a strength athlete than I was then. But there's sometimes, and this morning this happened, is that I'm doing this CrossFit workout. There's this guy in the gym with me as a part of this group class. There's probably 15 people in the class. His name's Austin. He's chiseled out of stone, looks like a Greek god, all this kind of stuff. And he is just crushing this workout. And I'm on this treadmill doing my quarter mile sprint as a component of the CrossFit workout. And I'm looking at him doing so well. And it was kind of like the lower side towards the back on me. I can feel it start to like, it's like a little ball just, you know, getting more and more intense. And since there's so much repetition with this stuff, but it's one of those things where like even doing over 100 episodes of this specific thing and probably talking to 30 or 40 therapists on the podcast, I still have those moments where I'm like, oh, shit, what did I just lift? And then a half a second later, I'm like, I'm comparing myself to this guy. Like our lives are very different. You know, our circumstances are very different. And that there is something there where I'm ultra competitive, but only in the sense that I compare myself way too much to other people, whether it's the car they drive or the house they live in or the, you know, the way that they look or as strong and as fast as they are. And just being able to reconcile and let that kind of thing go and just say it is what it is and it's okay is like, I guess, what do you think about that as a strategy? Sort of, you know, my two girls, big Frozen fans, right? Let It Go is on all the time. And I think that Elsa is one of the premier characters when it comes to TMS in the movie world. Her big phrase is "Let It Go." And if you saw Frozen 2, I don't know if did you see Frozen 2?
I didn't. I didn't see it yet. My kids are actually a little bit scared of. We joke about Disney because, you know, if you make a Disney movie, you have to immediately kill the parents.
Right.
I haven't seen that yet.
It is sensational. And one of the things she's always trying to come to terms with, like sort of a lot of these fears that she has internally. And I don't know, the whole thing I think is just so appropriate in terms of the things that I'm really into when it comes to TMS type stuff. But I mean, for you, and you said that a lot of the times it's not necessarily these external stressors, but it's our relationship with ourselves. Does it come down to people? I mean, is the best advice, don't be so hard on yourself? Because that seems much more easier said than done.
It is. The way I would phrase it is a little bit different, but related to that, which is you have to remember that no matter who you're looking at and no matter how good they may look from a certain angle, it is very hard to be a human being.
Yep.
Everybody is on a hard journey with themselves. Everybody. Some might have some challenges that are more significant than others, but nobody's got it easy. Nobody.
It makes me think, and this is the final couple of thoughts before I want to wrap up, because I have one, you could think it's the best question in the world. You could say this is really what we're ending on, but the good news is we'll do a part two. It reminds me of, there is a woman who's in one of these TMS groups that I'm a part of on Facebook, and I adore her, and she used to actually live pretty close to me. Now lives on, she's on the best coast still, but she's on the southern tip. She actually lives not far from Julie, ironically now. But she had posted something a day or two ago. She's going through nursing school, or might even be nursing practitioner school, and she posted the picture of her badge that she got. She went, you know, went through all the schooling stuff, but she's been in pain for a long time, like fibromyalgia type all over, you know, pelvic pain, like kind of everything. And she had said that she's been sitting there in class the last little while and just feeling like there's all these people around here that are, you know, I'm struggling while I get through this. I'm a parent, I'm in pain, all this kind of stuff. And they have it so easy because they don't have any of these kind of problems and stuff. And I had just said to her, you know, first of all, I think that you're wonderful. You know, I really love the way that you're sharing your kind of story and stuff. But I had said, just consider this for a second, is that those people probably don't know that you're sitting there in excruciating pain either. You're not wearing a sign that says it. And so they may also be looking at you and saying, wow, like this woman is going through nursing school. She's doing all the same course load that I'm doing, yet she has several kids. I think she has two or three or four kids or something like that. And yet she's coming here and she's kicking ass. And what's wrong with me? Why couldn't I, you know, I struggled to get through all this stuff and I don't have any kids. I don't have a husband. I don't have this kind of stuff. So that's the kind of perspective it really sounds like you're talking about.
I think, yes, absolutely. And so, you know, I think it is easier said than done to just say, you know, don't be so hard on yourself. How do we do it? You know, that's what my book is about in relation to TMS. How do you do it? And when I'm working with patients, there's a lot of questions about how do you stop being hard on yourself? And I think a key factor is to recognize it as a part of the human condition, because then you stop singling yourself out about being a person. You know, you disable it at the basic source, and then you can get to the specifics. Why was I being hard on myself there? You know, how can I be more understanding to myself? It is easier said than done. It takes time, but I think the basic gist, and actually I think that this is in some ways a perfect note to finish on from my vantage point. I think that TMS symptoms are talking to us. It's us talking to ourselves. You know, there's a language that the body speaks, and we generally don't want to listen to it. We want it to just go away, stop, you know, because it's uncomfortable. But if you learn to speak the language, first of all, the symptoms do go away more quickly. But secondly, you will learn so much stuff about yourself that will help you have a better relationship with yourself. So one way to think about TMS is it actually is, I'm not going to call it a blessing because it's hell on earth, but it does bring self-knowledge when you get the relief, but you do need the relief. You can't just sit there in agony and be like, oh, I'm going to be philosophical about this, which is what some doctors kind of rely on because they don't know what else to say. But symptoms are telling, they're conversations with ourselves. I think of them as waking dreams. In dreams, we're talking to ourselves in our sleep, and then we have to interpret them. Symptoms are an even more direct line to what's going on unconsciously. They're dreams in waking life, and we are talking to ourselves, and we're saying important things.
So we're going to close on this, and you're going to think this is a good question, or you're going to think it's lame as hell. One thing that I was thinking about as we first started talking is, if you were to look at all the people that I have interviewed and all the therapists I've interviewed, Dr. Eric Sherman was the first male. You're the second male. Why does it seem, when I go out there and I look at what TMS therapists are out there that I can talk to and invite for an interview, why does it seem like there's hardly any men? What is it about? Even maybe it's psychology in general as a field. Maybe the statistics are out there and only 10% of psychotherapists are men. But what do you think it is? Why is that tough for me to find to bring onto the show? Because I think that the dynamic that you and I have, this has been by far one of my favorite interviews. And I feel like we have a great dynamic. And what do you think it is that there just doesn't seem to be that many men that focus on this stuff?
First of all, I don't think that's lame at all. I think that's a fascinating, wonderful question. It's something that I've wondered about in other contexts because, and this is very personal to me too, growing up without a dad in the picture for a while, and then even when my father, you know, stepped in and adopted me, it took time. And so I grew up with a perspective on life that was informed more by a woman than anyone else. And so I've always wondered about gendered kind of stereotypes and roles that people play. I had no idea that you've had trouble getting men on this, and I don't understand that at all. So, you know, the first answer to your question is we should keep talking about that because that's fascinating, and I don't know why. However, I do have at least one internal lead on it based on my own experience. And that is that I really think that it takes a certain bravery in men to to be a certain way, to be open. Society is not very good towards openness with men. Society is horrific with respect to women in all kinds of ways. But the thing that I think about is one of the reasons why I was just like, sure, I'll definitely go on this, is that I'm all about connections. And the more I've thought about it, this might be a really weird way of saying it, but I really think it's true. I am a man who's capable of thinking like a woman. This is not a gender identity confusion. But I value the things that I think women often value. And included in that is like, okay, what are we going to get out of this podcast? I don't know. Maybe men are so focused on achievement and or maybe some sense of the ego of something. I don't know. Fascinating question. We should explore more about it. But I do think that the reason I wanted to come on this show is that I want to reach as many people and help as many people, but I value any connection. That's just how I am. And you reached out to me and wanted to connect, and that told me everything I needed to know about whether this would be worth it. So I don't know. I think we should think some about, all right, how are the genders valuing different traits? I'll say one last thing, but I have a cousin who, she is working on election stuff, and she's working on getting women elected, primarily because I think the thinking is that the way that women think can be very helpful to have more of than we have. And I totally agree with that in the balance of things. But she said to me, I wonder though, because I want to support some male candidates, but how do I support them? You know, given that I'm saying, I think we need more women. And I'm like, and I said, you don't necessarily need you do need more women, but you also need men who can think like a woman, or at least who have similar values to a lot of women. So I think that's the thing I would say. Let's see if we can figure that out. That's a great question.
This would spin off into a whole nother episode, but something that I just want to make sure that I mention, because it came from Julie, was that we did like this, this micro therapy session in the last one that we did of these, and it's already aired by the time that we're recording this. But, I made this comment, like, I'm not even necessarily sure which identity it is that I want to associate myself with. Am I the rugged, tough guy that lifts weights and rides a motorcycle and has tattoos and, you know, is into like musculature and that kind of thing? Or am I the sensitive dad that has two little girls, and that's the, and she had made this great comment. She said, why can't you be both?
Yeah. I was going to say, not only why can't you be both, but you are both.
Right.
No, we're always trying to like separate out things, and instead we need to integrate. You're not only both of those things, you're many more things.
Yep.
And I look forward to learning more about who you are and sharing more about who I am. And I love this. This was great. I really appreciate it.
Dan, you are the man. We'll be doing another one of these sometime in the coming weeks, but I certainly appreciate you giving us an hour and 20 of your time now. And I'm looking forward to this being a continuation down the road.
Awesome. Thank you, Eddie.